Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Michael Shulman, New York Times bestselling author. He's got a new book out called Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he's been contributing since 2006. He's written in for The New York Times, Vanity Fair, The Believer, all sorts of places. And this book is great. It's a big, large tome. You've got a lot of Oscar history to cover here. You know, we've got almost a century of Oscar talk to get through here, so I'm gonna try and move through the eras. We're gonna get it all in here, but thank you for being on the show, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so there's a moment at the end of your book where you're talking about kind of the silliness of introducing, you know, the most popular Oscar category and the tension between rewarding what is the best movie of the year and what is the most popular movie of the year. And you have this line. It's interesting. Because the Oscars should be celebrating merit regardless of profitability, and they should be lifting up small movies. End quote. And I'm actually, after reading the book and getting this line, I wonder if that's actually true, right? I mean, your whole book is about the kind of underlying tension between what is actually good and what people are voting for, and, you know, why the Oscars were even created in the first place, right?
Well, yeah, the Oscars have always had a tension, a tug of war between whether to award size and spectacle and the sort of production value of film, or whether to ignore all that and lift up something that is sort of small and has a kind of a less showy version of the art form. I mean, from the very beginning, the first Academy Awards in 1929 had two top prizes. One was for Outstanding Picture, which went to Wings, a gigantic war movie with a lot of special effects and planes flying in the air and battle scenes. And the other category was Best Unique and Artistic Picture, which went to Sunrise, which was a little, a smaller kind of psychodrama. And I think you can see that tension through the decades. I mean, think about 1953, the year that The Greatest Show on Earth, the big Cecil B. DeMille circus spectacular, somehow beat, you know, High Noon, which is a less showy, spectacular, gigantic movie, but a much better movie in a million different ways. And I think all the way up to this year, you see that in the nominees, where you have Avatar and Top Gun Maverick, you know, big movies, sitting across from Tar and Women Talking. And I think it's, and then you have something that sort of combines the two of them, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is why I think that's one reason I think it's got so much momentum. It kind of has both in one package. But I do think the Academy is always pulled between what to reward, the size and scope, and this sort of sheer magnitude of filmmaking power, or movies that hone in on something small and do it really well.
Well, let's even take it a step back further than that, because, you know, one of the things I love about your book, and it's a topic I knew a little bit about, but I learned a lot here, is the actual formation of the Academy, the actual introduction of the Oscars, which was done at least in part to stymie union building activity in Hollywood, in the industry, you know, kind of try to show folks, hey, you know. If you want to win the big awards, you can't necessarily join the union. You got to be part of the Academy. What was the t- talk us through that and the impetus of some of the producers and the stars and the directors who were instrumental in the founding of the Academy and the Oscars.
Yeah, that was certainly a part of it. So the Academy was founded in 1927 by 36 people who were a cross-section of very powerful people in silent-era Hollywood. But the idea came from Louis B. Mayer, the very powerful head of MGM. And the rhetoric that the early Academy had was, it was very utopian. It was all about creating harmony in the industry among the various factions in the industry at the time. And it was about lifting up, you know, the art of motion picture, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But if you look a little closer about why they were saying those things, one of them was that Hollywood was not a union town, except for the craftspeople, but the actors, directors, and writers were not unionized. There were signs that that might change. Actors' Equity, which organized stage actors back east, was trying to make inroads in Hollywood. And people like Louis B. Mayer knew that if that happened, it would be a huge thorn in his side. And so when they talk about harmony and how, you know, everyone was fighting, that, you know, producers were fighting with writers and directors were fighting with executives, what the Academy did in large part in its early years was oversee contract negotiations and mediate disputes. You know, if an actor was fired unfairly or a writer claimed they didn't get paid enough for a draft, the Academy would step in and hear cases and deliver verdicts. And this was extremely controversial from the start because the rank and file in Hollywood believed that this was essentially a tool of the producers to kind of preempt real unionization and kind of control all mediation and contracts. And this turned very, very ugly in the 30s when, you know, after... So basically, the Academy's existence successfully repelled Actors' Equity in the 20s, essentially, and unions, it preempted the formation of unions until during the Depression, the guilds rose up, you know, SAG and the Screenwriters Guild, the Screen Directors Guild. And once those bodies existed, they really went to war with the Academy, all-out war. They told their members to send in their resignations. They could not be in the Academy. They later in the 30s, they started boycotting the Oscar ceremony. It was not guaranteed that the Academy would exist because everyone hated it so much. And the way this got resolved was that Frank Capra, who was the president of the Academy for a long time in the 30s, he loved the idea of the Academy. He loved winning Oscars. He thought this was important that this thing survive. And so he essentially decided that, okay, if everyone hates the fact that the Academy is weighing in on labor disputes and economic issues, we're just not going to do that anymore. And so the Academy just stopped doing those things and they kept the Oscars, which was the only thing that they did that people in Hollywood seemed to like because everyone wanted to win this award.
What was it about the Oscar that appealed to Frank Capra so much? Because I mean, it is a really interesting little kind of sidebar in this whole big story. Is that like Frank Capra is like desperate to win an Oscar? He's desperate. He wants the praise and the. But he also finds himself, you know, kind of between a rock and a hard place here because he at the same time doesn't want to. You know, look like a shill for the studios. He doesn't want to sell out his fellow directors and other artisans. Mm-hmm. What was that all about?
Exactly. I mean, well, Capra wrote an autobiography, The Name Above the Title, which is a really fun, amusing book and not completely trustworthy because Capra kind of rewrote his life story to be a Capra comedy. You sort of read these tales of his coming up in the world and it sort of feels like, you know, Mr. Deeds goes to town or something. Everything is very plucky and falls right into place. But it's really interesting to hear his version of events and how he saw himself, which was as this impoverished immigrant who came from Italy as a child and pulled himself up by his bootstraps and kind of used his wit and his wiles to become the most successful director in Hollywood. He saw the Academy as the ultimate manifestation of the establishment, and he wanted to be part of the establishment. And he saw winning an Oscar as a way to do that, and he pursued it. I mean, the way he tells it, he just basically decided what movie to make based on what would win him an Academy Award. And then once he did that with It Happened One Night, he became president of the Academy and sort of became the establishment. I mean, this is sort of what he wanted. He wanted to be part of that echelon. And fascinatingly, at the minute he becomes Academy president, he is now being besieged by these guilds. And he was, you know, he was a Republican. He really was not that interested in labor organizing. But then suddenly his own peers, the Screen Directors Guild, this brand new thing, they wanted him. You know, he was the most successful director, and he was sort of brushing off this union until they finally got him to join. Then he became president of the union, and suddenly he was fighting himself because that union was at war with the Academy, which was him. And so he has this great tale that he, of course, dresses up with all sorts of hijinks, believe them or not, where he actually sort of he threatened to destroy the very Academy Awards ceremony that he was supposed to host as president, unless the producers, you know, recognized his guild and gave into their demands. And it all worked out in the end, just in time. And he, you know, emceed the Oscars. But you know, I mean, it was really a war. And you know, the spirit of the book is I looked for moments of major conflict, and throughout the 30s, that's what it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting to see kind of how Oscar fights also influenced credits for movies. I mean, this is particularly true in the world of screenwriting, I think. And there are two kind of moments in particular that are interesting and worth highlighting here. The first is the fight over Citizen Kane and the credit for Citizen Kane and who was going to actually get the screenwriter credit for that. Now, if you've seen Netflix original Mank, of course, yeah. We all know this story, but it is a really interesting little glimpse into how the Oscars and the glory that came with winning one kind of also empowered the very unions they were trying to repel, right?
Right. I mean, you know, the mediation over, you know, something went into dispute over who wrote the screenplay. That, of course, affects who gets potentially nominated or wins an Academy Award. So it has this extra importance. I mean, mostly I think screenwriters just want, they're fighting over credit if they're fighting at all. And then if they get nominated, then that's extra. But with Citizen Kane, that, you know, that dispute, which we all know about from Mank, resulted in Orson Welles and Herman Mankiewicz sharing credit on the screenplay, very uncomfortably sharing credit. And then that turned out to be the only award that Citizen Kane won at the 1942 Oscars. It, you know, notoriously lost everything but that. And Pauline Kael, who wrote about Citizen Kane famously and Mankiewicz's contributions decades later, felt that the only reason that the Academy gave them Best Screenplay was essentially because Mank was one of their own and Orson mm-hmm. Welles was an outsider. So if you believe that, you know, if it hadn't been for Mankiewicz's screenwriting co-credit, Citizen Kane might have gone completely empty-handed.
Yeah. And then we're about a decade or so later, we're into the Hollywood blacklist, and the Oscars play kind of a key role in breaking the power of the blacklist, right?
Right. I mean, I saved this chapter till last to actually write because I was sort of intimidated by the gigantic history of the blacklist and how dark it is. You know, really the darkest chapter in Hollywood history. Period, I think, and yet when I delved into this story, it turned out to be a kind of comedy within the tragedy of the blacklist, which was you had these screenwriters working on the black market under fake names, and they kept kind of accidentally winning Oscars, and the Academy didn't know what to do. You know, first you had you just had Dalton Trumbo, famously from the Hollywood Ten. He had gone to prison for defying HUAC. And then he wrote the story for this movie, The Brave One, under a fake name, Robert Rich. And then Robert Rich won the Oscar in 1957, and no one could find this guy because he wasn't real. And so it became what Life magazine called a "Who Won It." Everyone was looking for Robert Rich, and Trumbo, who was so clever, realized that he could use this mini scandal to turn the tables on the Academy and try to destroy the blacklist. The Academy had just instituted a rule saying that if you were blacklisted, essentially if you had been in the Communist Party, or if you had not cooperated with a congressional committee, you would be disqualified from getting an Oscar nomination. And so there was this rule, this hard and fast rule. And Trumbo realized that he could sort of exploit the contradiction that these people were supposed to be blacklisted, and yet they were all over town writing for, you know, bargain rates, and they were writing movies that were now winning Academy Awards. They just weren't using their own names. So he would tell the press people that came to him asking, "Are you Robert Rich?" He'd say, "Oh, well, I mean, maybe. It might be me. It might be my friend Michael Wilson, you know, who's also blacklisted." Trying to create this play up the open secret that blacklisted writers were writing not just a lot of movies, but movies that now were winning Academy Awards. And after 2 years of this farce, the Academy ended up rescinding the rule because it was unenforceable. I mean, other crazy things happened, like the year after the imaginary Robert Rich won, The Bridge on the River Kwai won for its screenplay, which was credited to Pierre Boulle, who wrote the book that the movie was based on. Well, everyone knew Pierre Boulle barely spoke or wrote in English. You know, he's a Frenchman. And everybody basically knew that the people who actually wrote the screenplay were two blacklisted screenwriters, Michael Wilson and Carl Foreman. And so suddenly you have like another fake Oscar being given out, and you know, every time this happened, Trumbo would just delight and like plan, you know, from behind his typewriter in the bathtub, just kind of sort of plot his next move, and they finally sort of overcame the Academy rule.
Yeah, I mean it's a funny chapter for sure. One of the kind of rolling regular controversies regarding the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences is who is actually qualified to vote on the Oscars. Who do they open up the roles to? And most recently, we saw that, you know, with the efforts the Academy made to diversify their ranks, right? They added younger members, more members from minority groups, more members from foreign countries, mm-hmm. Which I think, you know, people credit for, among other things, helping Parasite win Best Picture. You know, Moonlight, right, was benefited from that probably. And yeah, everyone's like, "Oh my gosh, well, this is, you know, this is so controversial." But this has happened before. This has happened before, right? There's an interesting story in your book about the team up of Gregory Peck and Candace Bergen to kind of get New Hollywood in through the doors of the Academy. What was that? Tell us that story. What was that all about?
Yeah. So this was 1969. Gregory Peck, who was well past his Atticus Finch days, was the president of the Academy. And it was very clear to him that there was a problem. You know, Hollywood in general was behind the times. It had no idea how to speak to the youth audience, you know, except for these notable exceptions like 2001 A Space Odyssey and The Graduate. But, you know, the Oscars were giving Best Picture to Oliver, you know? And those groundbreaking movies like The Graduate, 2001, weren't really winning. Peck realized that something had to change. And then along came Candace Bergen, who was 22, 23. She was a young starlet and kind of it girl. But she'd been raised in Hollywood. And her father was, of course, Edgar Bergen, the ventriloquist. And she watched the awards in 1969 and just thought, I don't see anyone my own age. I don't see anyone like me. I don't see any movies that reflect me. So she wrote to Gregory Peck, and their exchange, which is wonderful, is all preserved in his papers at the Academy Library. And basically said, the Academy is full of antiquities who are, you know, gumming up the works of the Academy. You need new blood. Can I go out and recruit some of my hip friends, essentially? And Peck said, yeah, sure, be my guest. Here are some some membership cards. And she went out and found people like Dennis Hopper, who was, you know, of course, this wild man who is coming out with Easy Rider. And, you know, she was very uniquely positioned to bridge the generation gap, Candace Bergen. And at the same time, and so she got a bunch of people in. At the same time, Peck was planning something much more dramatic, which was to institute a new rule that said if you hadn't worked in 7 years, you would be relegated to non-voting status. And so he came out with this plan right after the 1970 awards, and also preserved in his papers at the Academy Library are the angry letters that he got from old-timers saying, you know, how dare you? And, you know, people who had worked on Abbott and Costello movies in the 30s and said, how dare you tell me that I'm, you know, irrelevant? And meanwhile, you bring in, like, you know, Barbara Streisand becomes a member before her first movie's even out, you know, funny girl. And so you just saw this clash of generations where Peck kind of was in the middle and realized he had to steer the ship and get with the times. And all of this should sound familiar to anyone who followed, you know, the post-Oscar So White controversy in 2016, where something very similar happened. And the Academy decided it needed to bring in a lot more diverse members, whether that was age, race, gender, geography. And there was a ton of pushback and outcry. And they were also demoting certain people to what they called emeritus status, where you couldn't vote for the Oscars if you were out of the industry. And it just hit on this very Hollywood sort of fear of obsolescence. So it was fascinating to me how history kind of repeated itself. And in fact, in 2016, the president of the Academy at the time, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, in a letter to the membership, used the Gregory Peck initiative as a precedent for what she was doing.
Let's talk a little bit about the research, because it's interesting to hear you talk about the going to the Academy Library and going through the papers. What was the research process like for certainly the first half of or so of this book? I mean, you're dealing with people who are, you know, long dead in certain cases, or less long dead, but still not around. And there's just a wealth of information here. So, I mean, what was your actual research process like? Did you just go to libraries? Were you going through personal papers? What was that process like?
Well, it took me about 4 years to finish the book. And that was really just because of how much research I had to do. You know, I felt like in order to write, you know, even just a chapter about the 1942 Oscars, I had to learn everything there was to know about, you know, how Hollywood in general responded to the outbreak of World War II, et cetera. Things that have been written about Citizen Kane and all that. But the research process really changed from one era to the next. I mean, the book starts in the 20s. Obviously, no one's alive. No immediate descendants of those people are alive. So it was really about going to libraries, mostly the Academy Library, and here in New York, the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, and you know, reading old books that had been published from the time and from the year since. Reading contemporary press, you know, like old issues of Variety, how things were covered at the time, you know, magazines that are long, 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 long gone that went into depth about all of the politics and the this and that. And then letters, you know, private correspondence, you know, they have so much great stuff, especially at the Academy Library. I mean, I was reading telegrams between Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. I mean, just incredible stuff. And, like, you know, the correspondence that the Academy had with Adolf Zucker, the head of Paramount, about accepting the first ever Academy Award for Outstanding Picture, and him, you know, there was a draft of, like, his acceptance speech, which was pre-filmed as a sound film, a short sound film to be shown at the ceremony because he was stuck in New York. So there's incredible stuff to find. And then as the eras got a bit later, suddenly there would be, you know, maybe someone to interview, maybe a descendant. Like, I talked to Trump, you know, Dalton Trumbo's daughter and Gregory Peck's sons and people like that. And once I hit the sort of 70s, suddenly people started to be really around who had worked on the films. And until I got to the present, you know, the last big chapter is about the year of Oscar So White and Moonlight and La La Land. And those people are not only still around, but very much still in the industry. And that reporting was much more similar to kind of the Hollywood reporting that I do for The New Yorker, where I'm calling people up. People are anxious about, you know, what to say about their peers because they're still in the biz. And it was just totally different.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And you can feel it reading the book, because there's a definite shift from, you know, things are in the past tense to things are in the present tense, which, as any close reader of magazines or newspapers will tell you, like, okay, he's talking. This is me as a journalist reading it, thinking right. Like, oh, okay, he's talking to somebody now. He's, you know, as opposed to reading old correspondence or something. Yeah. It's just really interesting.
And several people died while I was writing the book. And I started putting their quotes in past tense, like she said, because she was gone. I mean, several people. Louise Fletcher talked to me about playing Nurse Ratched in Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and she just died, you know, last year. And that was one of the last changes I made to the book, to sort of acknowledge that Louise Fletcher was no longer alive.
All right. So back to the meat of the book. You know, I have a very serious, very serious question here. This is the thing I was most shocked by in your book, frankly. We have to have some real talk here. The Snow White Rob Lowe intro, which you insist is not as bad as everybody remembers it, makes it out to be. It's the subtext of that whole chapter, is that the producer that year got a bad rap. He got you know, kind of screwed by everybody. What is your take on that was the 89 Oscars, the 1989 ceremony?
The notorious 1989 Oscars, which are always talked about as the worst Oscars ever. And that they open with an 11-minute opening number that infamously featured Rob Lowe singing Proud Mary with a woman dressed as Snow White in a replica of the Coconut Grove with dancing cocktail tables. I mean, it's just, it's insane. It's absolutely insane. And it's bad. You know, it's schlocky and over the top and completely campy. And people were kind of horrified by it at the time. But I do think that I wanted to change the way we think about it, essentially, because it's sort of just brought up every year as this joke, worst Oscars ever. Oh, wasn't that horrible? Snow White. First of all, if you just look at the year before, it was just as schlocky, you know. The ceremonies throughout the 80s started with these big, crazy production numbers. And, you know, I start that chapter with the 1988 Academy Awards describing, you know, Pee Wee Herman, you know, presenting an award and being attacked by RoboCop with, like, laser shooting. I mean, like, the Academy Awards of the 80s were very tacky. And so the 1989 opening number was kind of just the apotheosis of it, but it got all the blame. And a lot of that has to do with Alan Carr, who was, he was best known for producing Grease, but also for being a kind of flamboyant, over-the-top figure. He threw these lavish house parties at his home. And, he was known for wearing an array of designer caftans. And he was a very flamboyant, openly gay man at a very homophobic time. And he dreamt his whole life of producing the Oscars. He finally got the chance, and it ruined his life, essentially. But part of the reason is that he wanted everyone to know, these are the Alan Carr Oscars. These are going to be the biggest, most glamorous Oscars you've ever seen. I'm going to bring back the glamour, bring back the style. And he put his name everywhere. So, you know, most people don't know who's producing the Academy Awards year to year. I mean, unless you're really inside the Oscar thing, people don't pay attention. But Alan Carr had put his name everywhere. And then he had staged this gigantic opening number that got terrible reviews. And because it got terrible reviews, Disney threatened to sue the Academy for, you know, unlawful use of their Snow White design. And because all of this was creating such terrible press for the Academy, this group of Hollywood elders like Gregory Peck and Blake Edwards and Julie Andrews all got together and signed an open letter to the Academies talking about what an embarrassment this ceremony had been. So it just built and built and built. There was this snowball effect, and everybody knew where to point the finger, which was Alan Carr, because he had put his name absolutely everywhere. And And so his life was, you know, his career was ruined overnight. You know, it's really a sort of, in the way that I said before, in The Blacklist, I kind of found a comedy about The Blacklist within the tragedy. For this chapter, I really felt like I was finding a tragedy within the comedy, because all of the details of it are completely insane and like over the top and 80s and schlocky and nuts. And yet there was this real person at the center who was a kind of Icarus figure who flew too close to the sun and then, you know, fell into the sea. You know, for the Oscars, the impact that it had was that they set up a committee to review the quality of the show. And then the next year, you really have the first kind of modern Oscars, where it was the first year that Billy Crystal hosted, and it was much more pared down. There wasn't a gigantic, lavish production number that seemed trapped in another age from, like, you know, variety TV of the 70s. It was the 1990 awards, and you had Billy Crystal come out and, you know, do a stand-up routine. And so, yeah, so it had a lot of impact for just the way that the ceremony evolved.
And that is kind of what we have now still. I mean, this is why you have Whoopi Goldberg hosting, Chris Rock hosting. I mean, this is the kind of standard form of the show going after.
Yeah, and there had been hosts, you know, like Bob Hope. But you notice the shift if you go from 1989 to 1990. You know, they sort of realized, okay, we cannot put on a giant variety show with, like, chorus girls, you know, dancing in Oscar suits anymore, because people had recoiled so much from the Snow White, Rob Lowe thing.
Yeah. Moving into the 1990s then, throughout the whole decade, really, the Oscars becomes the Harveys. I mean, it is a tricky time in the industry, because Harvey Weinstein and his brother are basically elbowing their way into every awards race, every conversation. They're running aggressive campaigns. They're running aggressive negative campaigns, which is something that, you know, is very much frowned upon in the Oscars. How did that change the landscape of the Oscar competition? I mean, I lived through this era. It's always kind of interesting to read the postmortems and the ways in which Weinstein understood that you could wrap a movie in politics and with political figures and buy yourself a lot of cover and free press.
Oh, that's right. I mean, one of the things that he did was sort of kind of create humanitarian campaigns that made his movies seem like they were causes, you know, even going back to My Left Foot. You know, he brought Daniel Day-Lewis to Washington and screened the movie for, you know, 50 senators. And, you know, all the way going up to, like, Silver Linings Playbook, which he sort of turned into an important movie about mental illness, which I really don't think it is. And Lion, which was his last campaign year, was Lion. And he placed this really tone-deaf ad after Trump came to power, with the face of that the little boy from India who had some kind of red tape problem getting to the premiere. And the ad said something like, you know, it took mountains of, you know, getting over mountains of red tape to get Sonny Pawar to the premiere of Lion. Next year, he may not be able to, you know, and it's so tasteless, but he just pushed every conceivable angle. So throughout the 90s, Miramax was growing and gaining a lot of power and visibility. And one of the ways that Harvey Weinstein did that was through very aggressive Oscar campaigns. So, you know, he would do things like have his staff members call Academy members at home to say, oh, you know, have you seen the movie? Can we set up a screening? Have you seen it? Did you like it? What do you think? Just sort of relentlessly calling everyone. And he would find little pockets of Academy members. You know, if there were three Academy members living in, you know, the Phoenix area, he'd set up a screening of something for them. And then just bring everyone from the movie, the talent, on, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of relentless campaign stops, you know, and cocktail parties. And spent a lot of money. So much money that sometimes people who made the movies, who were supposed to get, you know, profits on the back end, realized that all disappeared because it had gone into the Oscar campaign. So yeah, it was really about, you know, none of these things were necessarily things that he invented, but he saw himself as an underdog, and he saw Miramax as an underdog, because it was the New York indie company, despite the fact that it was eventually acquired by Disney. And so, you know, he really felt justified in just pulling out all the stops. That chapter about him culminates with the 1999 Oscar race between Shakespeare in Love and Saving Private Ryan, which is very much remembered as the ugliest Best Picture fight ever. And I think that was really the inflection point, because it was so ugly. It involved, part of this story had to do with DreamWorks, which really felt like, okay, this is, you know, Saving Private Ryan is like our marquee movie. It's the first movie they came out with since they had been created in 1994. That was a huge hit. It was a Spielberg movie. It was the obvious front runner for Best Picture. And then along comes Shakespeare in Love from Miramax that kind of changed the conversation completely. And what really made it ugly was that DreamWorks heard through the grapevine that Weinstein was telling journalists to write that Saving Private Ryan was only good for the first 25 minutes, the famous D-Day sequence. And then after that, it just became a standard World War II movie. And so once DreamWorks heard that, it just became this all-out war where that spilled over into the press. I mean, there was a Nikki Fink article in New York Magazine talking about how contentious this battle was. And I think people hadn't really... The general public had not been paying so much attention to the mechanics of Oscar campaigning in this way. But when Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture, it was such a shock. The DreamWorks head of marketing at the time, Terry Press, says that she was in the mezzanine watching and she said, "I felt like my face was on fire." There was this just groundswell of resentment and anger toward Weinstein. And Hollywood didn't want that to happen again. They felt this guy had come to their turf and taken something from them. So they essentially replicated his playbook. The next year, DreamWorks had American Beauty, and they did everything they thought Harvey Weinstein had done and doubled it and outspent every other studio in campaign spending, in ad spending. And then the next year they won with Gladiator. And then 2 years later, Harvey was back and won for Chicago. And so as the people in the studios realized that they needed to play Harvey Weinstein's game, that's how this so-called Weinstein playbook spread. And this ecosystem was created of strategists and nonstop year-round campaigning and big money, to the point where the Academy had to start creating rules to sort of rein it all in.
Well, and this also gives rise to it kind of creates the ecosystem for the Oscar bloggers, right? Your awards dailies and that sort of thing. I was a little surprised that you didn't talk more about that, because it feels like, I mean, maybe this is just me looking at it from the outside as a person on Twitter and a reader of blogs, but it yeah. feels like, you know, that was like, that's like a fairly big part of the story of the Oscars, certainly through the late 2000s to the mid 2010s, that it didn't feel like it got a lot of play in your book. I'm curious if, from your perspective, as somebody who is, you know, kind of following the ins and outs of all this stuff, was it just not that important? Was the narrative setting amongst the Oscars bloggers not really that important as certainly they made it out to be and everybody else?
Well, to be honest, my Weinstein chapter got incredibly long and I had to cut a lot of things and just felt like I couldn't go to couldn't go into everything. But I do have a little bit of that in there. It was really interesting to see how the growth of the cottage industry that was happening around the turn of the 21st century that I just discussed was happening at the same time as the burgeoning of the blogosphere and sites popping up like Oscar Watch and Gold Derby, all these things that created this other parallel cottage industry of Oscarologists that we have now, people who are covering it and prognosticating year round. I think those two things they're not the same thing, but they're related in the sense that I think that the contentiousness and the mechanics of the 1999 race had become so public that people were thinking about just the campaign in a different way. People were thinking about the season in a different way. And it became more gamified and more online. And there was suddenly, you know, opportunities to follow this wild and crazy thing called award season, not just the week of the Oscars, but for months and months and months and eventually year round.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild times. Let's see. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to think about, especially as, again, like, Now you've got Film Twitter, which basically, you know, thinks that it is out there setting the agenda, and I'm not sure that's really the case. I don't get the sense that, you know, a ton of Academy members are necessarily paying attention, but maybe it is with the influx of newer and younger members.
Well, you definitely see with the rise of social media that there is pushback that sometimes has an influence and sometimes doesn't. But just think about Oscar So White. That was a hashtag. That was a trending hashtag that started in 2015 and then exploded in 2016. And if that hadn't happened, who knows if the Academy would have acted and done something by announcing this diversification initiative. But I think, you know, public pressure from social media certainly played a role that year. And I don't know, you know, I'm on Twitter. I follow the awards conversation on social media. And I think it's really interesting because there is some overlap between Film Twitter and the Academy, the actual voters, but there also is a lot of non-overlap, and that can lead to some whiplash when people are just surprised by what the Academy is doing, because we thought we had settled this on Film Twitter months ago. We decided that so-and-so was terrible, and this was bad, and that was good, and so-and-so is going to win. And it turns out the Academy is actually, like, you know, 9 or 10,000 people who some of them are on Twitter, and some of them are, like, you know, 80.
Yeah. We could call this the Green Book effect.
For sure.
The way to think about this. All right. That was everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about your book, about the Oscars in general, you know, what we've got coming. We've got an awards ceremony here in a couple weeks. We got right? What is it? March? What is it? It's coming up here. So what do you think folks should know?
The book is long, but it's really fun, I hope. You know, I wanted to make it entertaining. It does cover a lot of history, but, I wanted people to have a good time. And, I don't know, I'll be at the Oscars. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens this year. I don't think it'll top last year in terms of, you know, crazy shit happening, but we shall see.
Who are you wearing at the Oscars this year?
Important thing for people to know. I have finally, after years of renting tuxes from Men's Warehouse, invested in my own actual tuxedo, the first that I've gotten, that I've bought since my high school prom. So I will be hitting the red carpet in my very own Men's Warehouse tuxedo this year, and I plan to wow.
Excellent, excellent. That's good to know. Michael, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for reading the book.
The name of the book, again, it's Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. Michael Shulman is the author. You can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. And I definitely, again, if you're interested in the history of Hollywood, broadly, just more broadly even than the Oscars specifically, this is a must read. I mean, I think you can't understand the industry without understanding how the industry thinks of itself and what the industry wants to reward. I think it's an important, it's one of the most important lenses through which to see the business of showbiz. So check it out if you get a chance. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.